Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast.
Stephen, are we going to have to talk about Europe again?
Well, we could talk about the series of elections in the Republic of Ireland in Super Tuesday. We could do that instead, or we could do Europe.
We have to do Europe, don't we? Let's just reconcile ourselves to it. Also, can we just... Well, let's have a brief moment of allowing ourselves a moment of gloating about Super Tuesday and the fact that our belief that Bernie Sanders was not, in fact, going to rise up in a populist Jeremy Corbyn-like uprising and dethrone Hillary Clinton does appear to be so far borne out by the numbers.
Yep. It is this thing I find endlessly fascinating about US elections, and they are covered... Fine, my foreign correspondents who, you know, their readers don't find, but they're covered by American correspondents if they've never done it before. So the crushing defeats that Sanders suffered last night and in South Carolina were entirely foretold in the Iowa data. It's just that Iowa and New Hampshire don't look like the rest of America.
Well, can we also take a moment to say that I think America's problem, and I speak on behalf of my people here, is white people. They're making terrible choices. They either want unelectable left-wing candidates or they want Donald Trump. It is only the black and Hispanic populations of the US that are making halfway sane decisions in this election.
Yeah, I mean, I think... Because the interesting thing is we're now at the weird stage of US elections where everyone starts quoting head-to-head polling, going, oh, but, you know, but Trump beats Clinton. It's just like, well, maybe. I mean, I don't think that figure will be borne out either.
Also, it's really hard to extrapolate from that.
It's also state by state.
Yeah,
it's a completely different set of elections. And yeah, I mean, I think, I don't think it's so much that it's a problem with it, but I think that the problem with Sanders is that, one, actually the Clinton years were phenomenal for particularly for African Americans in terms of employment, in terms of average income. They were great years, and there is a reason why African Americans remember those years fondly. But the thing is actually Sanders' political narrative really only speaks to a certain section of white Americans. It's you know, like, oh, you know, you're the graduate with no future, you can't get onto the housing ladder, you can't get into the best. But that is just the African American reality, and it always has been. I mean, I think that's the interesting thing about this graduate with no future in general. Their aims are quite Tory, which is not a problem. It speaks to the kind of breaking down of the neoliberal model, and it can't deliver the things that these people have traditionally wanted. But it's actually a fairly conservative set of policy asks.
But that does kind of suggest why things like Right to Buy were so popular in the 80s. Although my stat to lead before we move on to Europe grown is that in the 2012 election, if only white men had voted, Romney would have won every single state. He would have won every electoral college, total sweep.
Yeah.
So you do have a very interesting demographic split in American politics between that is very hard between certain types of voters.
Yeah.
But what could be more thrilling than Europe? I'm really struggling. I'm really struggling because I know that as journalists, it is our duty to bring people facts, and yet the facts. I tried catching up a bit of the... There was a sovereignty debate in the Commons. I tried catching up a bit of that. It was unbearable. Then there was some questioning of Matt Hancock about one of the government's ministers about this idea that they're not going to be... People in Brexit supporting ministers are not going to be able to see civil service advice that they could then use to bash the government. And I can't do it, Stephen. I can't do it.
So I have 2 points. One not serious, one serious. The not serious one is increasingly Brexit to me sounds like some kind of bran-based cereal that you might take if you're having trouble with your bowel movements.
Yeah, like, start the day with Brexit.
Yeah. But so I have actually bizarrely kind of got religion on the Europe debate now. I've decided I am properly excited by it. Not because I'm losing my hair. I'm not, by the way. I'm really not. But yes, yeah, so I'm not like one of these bold men who's into Europe. But ultimately, if we were to leave the European Union, Scotland would certainly leave the United Kingdom. Northern Ireland would be thrown into financial chaos. There would potentially suddenly be a hard border between the six counties and the rest of the island. It would be a disaster. Sterling would tank, and those are literally just the problems that we know about.
Yeah,
you know, it is. You know, kind of. And I think the problem is that Parliament so far. Yeah, obviously journalists, we make mistakes too. He said through gritted teeth. But Parliament, I think, is failing to get its hands round the size of the debate. You know, the kind of sovereignty question is so small bore compared to the kind of truly catastrophic implications of leaving the EU.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to somebody who works in science, and they said, you know, 99% of scientists support us staying in the EU because so many big scientific projects now, you know, something like the Large Hadron Collider in CERN has got dozens and dozens of nationalities of people working on it. Mm. You know, most times when people win a Nobel Prize now, you know, they're as a result of kind of cross-border collaborations. So there are some really significant groups of people who aren't getting a hearing. My problem with the debate is that it's all just been shaved down into a sort of personality clash. And that's, I can see that's really tempting. And I'm loath to castigate anyone else doing this because I know that we have ended up, ourselves have been guilty about seeing things through the prism of personality in left-wing politics. But I just feel like framing it as Cameron versus Boris is just, I just don't care enough about either of them that, you know, and I am turning into that slightly sanctimonious left-wing person that is kind of, I'm going to meet, my future, I feel, is very much leaving comments like saying, what about Syria, on Guardian articles about fashion. That's where I'm heading on this.
Well, there's only one cure for that, death.
No, but I think it's really difficult because, you know, from all the people that I've been talking to about this, I've been trying to talk to quote-unquote normal people. And the thing that comes across really strongly is people just want facts, right? The newspapers are very partisan. They've already very much decided where they're going to stand. I can't really think of a newspaper. I mean, perhaps if the Indy RIP were going to carry it, you wouldn't know quite which way that was going to back. But, and I think it feels a lot like walking in on season 5 of a box set. And all the characters are already established, all the plot lines and themes were, people are referring to things that happened in season 1 that you weren't there for. That's how I think a lot of people feel about it. And that very rolling way that we do news, where we do it in micro updates, particularly in politics, where we assume that everybody's been totally switched on, is really doing a disservice to Europe when actually, has anyone heard the fundamental debate questions for 30, 40 years?
No, and it is. I mean, it's kind of like, I mean, one of the things I try to avoid doing, not just because I'm lazy, but also because I don't think it serves the ordinary reader very well, is this kind of so-and-so says something on Twitter, everyone is very angry about it, including the kind of second-order hot takes, which assume that everyone has already come to it. And I think, yeah, exactly that kind of... And it is also like season 5, because it's a bit of a cruddy debate, really.
Well, the original showrunner has left, isn't it? It's one of those. And then actually they've decided to introduce a kind of lesbian vampire character.
Yeah.
I'm thinking really of True Blood here.
Yeah. Speaking of the original showrunner, the interesting thing I have noticed about this campaign is the way that it has transformed the opinion of lots of Labour people about Cameron, not in terms of his politics. They're still strongly opposed to him. But, I mean, someone who's working very closely with Stronger In said to me earlier today, well, you know, I used to just think Cameron was lucky, but I now realise, you know, he's incredibly hardworking. He says exactly what, he sits and listens and goes, well, what are the problems voters have with me? What are the fears people have about leaving? What are the things we can do to... then they are kind of...
Well, there was that vignette, wasn't there, during the election of him sort of saying, I want, you know, in a memo where he said, I want you to sort of physically attack me with the arguments that people are going to come against me to his aides. Whereas the portrait of Ed Miliband that was painted was Ed Miliband going, why is everyone being so mean to me? Like, why can't anyone just be nice about things that I've said?
When Stan Greenberg presented him with polling about what people didn't like out of the Labour Party, and he said, well, Stan, why do you have to be so negative? And Stan Greenberg, to his credit, did not at that point throw him out of the nearest window, which I think I would have found hard not to do.
What I think we should ask our podcast listeners to do is set us some homework. So you can get us both on Twitter at Stephen KB and at Helen Lewis. And what factual things do you want to know? Because, you know, I am a SWAT. I love homework. If people ask me to go and find out specific things, then I will go and do that. And then I think that's how we should do it. We should, for the next couple of weeks, we should actually provide actual facts about Europe and try and do it in a way that doesn't make everyone want to cry. Okay?
Cool.
Hi. Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And we host the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman, Seriously.
If you secretly care more about comics than Jeremy Corbyn, this is the podcast for you.
You can find all our episodes at newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And now it's time to go down the line to the lobby with George.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, George.
So Jeremy Corbyn appeared at the Parliamentary Labour Party for the first time this year on Monday, and it's fair to say that expectations were low and that in many ways he fell below them. One shadow minister told me afterwards, if I gave a presentation like that to my constituency party, members would be justified in deselecting me. His 10-minute address opened by noting that membership had doubled since the general election. He spoke about the Lords' defeat of tax credit cuts, which was, of course, last October, so quite a distant event now. What Labour MPs would ideally have wanted was a big picture address on the EU referendum, on global economic uncertainty, and on Labour's strategy and plan to win the May local elections, and they didn't get that.
There's a perception, I think, that the Parliamentary Labour Party is sort of full of, it's kind of a, well, the term you use is insurrectionary unit in your column this week. Is that fair?
No, in that if you're talking about most MPs are not sort of on the point of rebellion. They moan about Jeremy Corbyn. Most of them certainly consider him to be unelectable. But they're in no mood to launch a challenge. Most of them hope, in the words of one Corbyn critic, that something will happen, but that they won't really have to do any of the work. Something will turn up. And of course, we've seen this in the past when Labour MPs moaned about Gordon Brown and Ed Miliband. But when it came to a challenge, a lot of them bottled it and, of course, only really tried to move 6 months before the general election when they started panicking about losing their seats. Those opposed to Corbyn still don't have an agreed candidate. I mean, some of the names going round are Angela Eagle, Lisa Nandy, who was described by one MP as on massive manoeuvres, Dan Jarvis, who's giving a speech on the economy soon in advance of the budget, and Owen Smith and Chukwuemunah. And the other person who is being spoken of as a potential future leader, though not or not gladly by Corbyn's critics, is John McDonnell, the Shadow Chancellor.
Yeah, I mean, why are people talking up McDonnell? Obviously, it's something we've mentioned on the NS website a couple of times, but it started to gain currency not just on the left, but throughout the Labour Party.
So what MPs have told me is that McDonnell is now in every significant internal meeting on policy and strategy across the piece. And there's some debate about why this is. Some say it's because of the toll the job has taken on Corbyn physically and intellectually, that he needs McDonnell, who has always been the senior partner in their relationship. He stood unsuccessfully for the leadership in 2007 and 2010. That he needs him to be there to support him. In the words of one MP, he just can't do it on his own. But others speculate that there's a deal or a tacit understanding between Corbyn and McDonnell that if Corbyn is challenged and removed, then McDonnell would try to take over, or that Corbyn will voluntarily step down at some point and hand the leadership to his great ally, the Shadow Chancellor. And of course, Ken Livingstone, who's very close to the Corbyn project, gave an interview to Anoush in The New Statesman recently, in which he said that McDonnell is the leader in waiting if anything happens to Corbyn, and also that he hopes to change the nomination rules so that a candidate of the left would no longer be required to get the nomination of a certain percentage of MPs and MEPs and could get on the ballot with just a few supporters. And that, of course, would remove what most see as the biggest hurdle to McDonnell winning.
One thing which could obviously happen, which might change the political situation, is the coming local elections, in which Labour is not expecting to do as well as an opposition would hope to do at this stage. John Trickett gave a presentation at the PLP meeting. How did that go down?
So that wasn't very well received. He was asked, why aren't we targeting any Tory councils? He conceded that the Tories' attack on Labour for endangering economic and national security was proving effective, and said that Labour's riposte would be, we'll stand up for you. Most weren't convinced by that. They didn't think there was a clear strategy, and the presentation itself was described as rather shambolic to me. And Labour's regional boards have been sent a list of 16 councils to focus on. All of them are currently held by the party, which shows that it's very much a defensive campaign. The last time an opposition failed to gain seats at a local election in a non-general election year was 1982. But it helps that expectations are so low. It helps that Sadiq Khan is still likely to win the London mayoral election, which happens at the same time. It helps that it's still relatively early in Corbyn's leadership. He hasn't even been in the job for a year. And most MPs will feel it is fair to give him more time. And it also helps that, as I said, there isn't an agreed candidate. And most fear, a lot of critics fear, that were Corbyn challenged, were he to automatically be on the ballot, as most expect, there's a reasonable chance that he could win by an even bigger margin than in September. A lot of a significant number of members who didn't vote for him have left the party. More left-leaning ones have joined since. And were that to happen, his leadership would, of course, be strengthened, and they wouldn't be able to launch another challenge, possibly for a few years. So that is seen as the risk. And it's these conversations which are taking place ahead of what all sides expect to be a bad set of results.
All right. Thank you, and talk to you next week.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And it's time now to talk about the Oscars, and indeed films more generally, with Anna Liskowitz, on loan from the Seriously podcast.
Hiya.
Anna, we made you do something slightly unfair, which is that we made you stay up all night to watch the Oscars. So I'm guessing by the time they were handing out, like, best foreign short, you were in a kind of slightly diabetic coma from having to eat too many Revels to keep you awake.
Yeah, I was actually able to keep all my snacks in my eye bags though by that point, so it was fine. No, I actually really enjoyed it. It was fun to watch. I think mainly because this year was a bit more surprising maybe than other years. Like, it was less like, oh, another award for Birdman or whatever.
I think it's astonishing when I was thinking about it quite how many awards the entertainment industry gives itself. And then I thought, journalists are in no place to complain about this one. If they're a profession that gives itself more awards than journalism, then yeah, maybe acting is just about it.
Speaking of which, Anna was recently shortlisted for an award, as indeed was I, which I imagine our listeners may have forgotten since the last time I mentioned it.
That's good. Unfortunately, our listeners can't vote for either of you, can they? So, I mean, it's nice. It's nice to mention it.
But on the subject at hand, can we talk about how bad Birdman is?
Yeah, I really, when Stephen said, let's talk about the Oscars, I thought, am I just going to hijack this to bring up all my grievances with Birdman? Because what happened was that I thought, oh, it's like, I don't know what made me watch it. Actually, I don't know,
because it sounds cool. It's like Bruce Keaton, not Bruce Keaton.
Is it a bird? Michael, is it a man? Keaton. It's Birdman.
As a washed-up actor who used to play a superhero, who hears the superhero talking to him, who's trying to do a serious film, it suggests that it would be a fun, clever, enjoyable movie that was not boring to watch.
I guess I sort of thought it might have a bit of the flavour of Jessica Jones in that sort of sort of sullen, misanthropic, superhero-y kind of thing. And I also thought it might have a bit of the postmodernism of, like, Watchmen, for example. You know, about the whole... I thought it was more super heroic than it in fact turned out to be. So I also, this is another thing, it's the big gimmick of Birdman is that it's filmed in a continuous pan, right? And then there are a couple of things that are then sewn together digitally. So it looks like it is just, you are just following one person around. Mm. I sort of didn't entirely get that because I watched it at home and I may have spent quite a lot of time on my phone.
Making cups of tea.
I mean, yeah. I watched it in a cinema, and I think if I hadn't watched it in a cinema, I would not have got to the end. I didn't pick up on the fact it was a continuous shot. I also, I'm always a bit dubious of films where like, oh, well, this, the selling point is something. It's a bit like Avatar, which is the big selling point was, oh, the graphics. But it's a boring Pocahontas remake than the... Once again, if I hadn't been watching in the cinema, I would have walked out of because it was so dull.
Yeah. The other thing is the drumming. The drumming reminds me of why I have a deep hatred of jazz. It just that drumming began to feel like every time someone has tried to engage me in a conversation about how jazz is actually a lot more musical than types of music that feature actual music.
Hey, jazz is great.
Well, no, I'm some jazz is great. The jazz drumming of Birdman's score. Can you defend that?
No, but there's no aspect of Birdman I would defend. I haven't actually seen The Revenant, but Anna, you have. You've seen Birdman as well, right?
I haven't seen Birdman, and don't. I think I'm not going to.
I wish do you think was worse?
Well, I can't imagine a film that I would have disliked much more than The Revenant. And I don't want to be like, it is the worst film ever made, because as discussed, the director has like some very interesting technical abilities that are cool, but technical...
So he filmed it in natural light only, didn't he? Which necessitated for filming for like 2 hours every afternoon, yeah. And that was kind of it.
Yeah, that's what Leonardo DiCaprio was talking about in his speech when he sort of went off on one about climate change at the Oscars, was the fact that they kind of had to chase sort of the light and the weather quite insanely around the world. But yeah, so, and there are some quite good, like, very long shots. It's obviously not like Birdman, and it is not all one shot, but there are these, like, quite interesting, like, fight scenes where you're, like, following the action round in one long track shot. But, oh God, apart from that, I really felt like it was... That, like that feeling when you're in a meeting with too many men who want to talk for too long and you're kind of like stood at the side of the room like, where's this going? Like, probably time to wrap it up now, guys. Like, that's The Revenant. Just is in a film. Like, the first
Stephen's
shot...
Stephen's giving you a look like, no, I've never been in that meeting. If you think you've never been in that meeting, Stephen's you that were man. That meeting.
I haven't. No, I was...
Yeah, it's very much like that. Like, I remember the opening shot of The Revenant is, like, the camera panning upstream. And, like, literally about 30 seconds into that shot, I was like, found some stuff you could cut already, guys.
Like, hustle just along.
Trim this a bit.
I mean, to sound like an old fogey, we recently been rewatching lots of films from the 90s. I don't quite know why. I think just somehow we have. And one of the many shocking things is how progressive Jurassic Park is compared to how sexist Jurassic World is. Is slightly startling, but also how short all of the like these 90-minute films where you're like, that film didn't need an extra hour or so.
Yeah, it's a bit like some of the conversations people have about long-form journalism. This idea that long-form journalism is inherently good journalism. This idea that like rambling man film is inherently good film.
Never mind the quality, feel the girth. It's like kind of like, and it, but I also think it's about something being kind of definitive, isn't it? It's about the idea that long-form. You have to be like, this is the piece. This is the piece in which I entirely explain baseball forever. And I think the films kind of aspire to that. And I think I think they get bloated if people aren't.
Yeah, I mean, my heart always sinks when it's like an American long read where it's like notionally about like, I don't know, drones, and it begins like Dwight Schultz is a tobacco maker in West Virginia. And you're like, oh God, how long am I going to be expected to endure before I get to whatever the point of this piece ostensibly is?
Yeah, and it's like The Revenant, which is, you know, supposedly a revenge film, a revenge piece about, you know, some guy avenging his son's murder. And when it was like an hour in and the son was...
a bear.
Yeah, that's part of it. But like literally an hour in when his son is still alive, I was like... Okay.
Does the bear kill his son, or is...
No, the bear, like, mauls his face a bit.
So why is the bear such a big...
The bear, like, basically makes him unable to stop his son's murder. So that's why the bear's important, because he's, like, in such a
So
does
he not actually
condition.
Successfully avenge his son?
No, that's basically... Then he has to, like, crawl out of a grave they've buried him in after him being attacked by the bear.
I don't mean to be rude, but even this is boring me.
It's really
dumb.
Are
you saying that this conversation is unbearable?
The most interesting thing about The Revenant is the fact that Leonardo DiCaprio's publicist made a statement saying that he was not raped by a bear during the making of the film, which involved a CGI bear.
But this is the other... Wow, okay. But that brings me very neatly to the thing that I think is my inherent problem with the Oscars, which is that it features rich, thin, attractive, wealthy, usually white off, you know, people who get applauded. Who get applauded for, like, cripping up, you know, like, gendering up. In the case of Charlize Theron, you know, like, looking like a, like, slightly skanky-ing up. You know, it's like, that's the thing that gets you your Oscar, right?
I have to defend Charlize Theron, though, because didn't she, famously, she watched her stepdad murder her mother when she was...
No, she did, and I think, but there is a real trend of the fact that, you know, like, Eddie Redmayne got his theory of everything, and then he kind of came back for another bite at the cherry by, okay, this time I'm going to put a dress on, and that's actually really hard for a male actor to do, to be seen like that, you know, it's really... because they, you know, they struggled for a really long time to cast that, the Danish girl. And I just think it's
slightly... And they settled on Eddie Redmayne?
Well, yeah. But I just sort of slightly offensive to the rest of us, to living Definitely. Normal lives, to disabled people, to trans people, to slightly puffy-faced people, that this is considered to be such a horrifying thing to do that you deserve praise for it.
Yeah, I think I'm willing to forgive Monster because it's such a good film.
Mm.
I think my problem is that there are a lot of films, including films I love, like, I mean, so A Single Man, I think, is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful film, but it is basically a particularly lovely catalogue with a quite nice kind of short story about a man grieving for his husband, kind of tacked on. But most of these sort of films where the central actor's just going, look, I've done something a bit different, please give me an Oscar now, are effectively like a variety show. More than
but that's gaying up, isn't it? Yeah. And that's again, that's Colin Firth, isn't it? A Single Man.
Yeah.
So an actor who's been married for many years to a woman doing it, and I have a difficult relationship with the whole you should cast an X actor to play X, because sometimes it seems
doesn't always work.
Yeah, it seems to ignore the concept of acting as a fundamental thing. But it did feel that it does seem very odd that essentially, like I say, very wealthy white men get huge amounts of applause for sort of dabbling with...
Same specific set of people that are reaping the rewards for these performances. It's a funny thing, though, because Leonardo DiCaprio, my favourite role of his is What's Eating Gilbert Grape, which I think is an amazing performance. So he plays a young person with cerebral palsy. My brother has very severe cerebral palsy, and watching that performance was just shocking to me because it was so accurate. And I would love for him to have won an award for that, but I can completely understand at the same time why people would be like, there are plenty of actors out there with cerebral palsy who are looking for roles, and they're few and far between, and that would have been a great one for them to have. So I see both sides of the argument, really, but the main problem is that, as you say, it's the same group of people that are getting rewarded for these performances time after time.
I was really surprised to see an infographic about the number of the top 100 best paid... Caroline Crampton had it in her newsletter, the best top 100 most paid actors, and how many of them have never acted in a single film with a female director.
Yeah, that was an amazing... This was in Cosmopolitan, right? Yeah. They did a really great investigative sort of piece about it where they,
Brad Pitt, the only female director he's ever worked for, was last year with his wife.
Yeah.
Whereas David... I can't remember.
Schwimmer?
No, from Selma. He has done 4 in a row, including Ava DuVernay, who's one of the only black female directors out there. And he said, you know, come on, this is up to the men who've got the power in the industry, you know, lobby for this. Like, try and, when you're putting together a slate of directors, try and put, you know, put a few wild cards on there and at least consider them, at least let them get through the door to, you know, then be rejected.
And the idea that there's actually a responsibility on people who are already successful to kind of be like, you know what, I'm going to work with women directors now from this point onwards for like the next 4 films I make or whatever. That's something that you have to make a conscious decision to do. They're not necessarily just going to like come to you and, you know, overcome all these obstacles necessarily on their own. So
That feeds into that debate. So I thought Chris Rock was a pretty good host from the bits that I'd seen. And I thought it was good that he took on head-on Oscar So White as a controversy. But I think it's an extra unfair burden on black actors that they should have to be the ones that are constantly talking about ethnic diversity. In the same way, I think it's really tough to expect, you know, women to go away and sort of sort out the pay gap.
Yeah, and it also ends up kind of pigeonholing them into like spokespeople for diversity, which isn't fair because it's everyone's problem, right? And it benefits everyone if we have a more diverse, you know, entertainment industry.
I mean, I think so. I haven't watched it at all because I'm super prepared. But I have bizarrely read a lot of the reviews of Chris Rock's performance, and I did feel it was simply kind of like, oh, you know, he should have tackled it more, or he should have done X, which is more like, it's like, but it's not actually Chris Rock's job to like stand up and just like and be the outlet for every. I feel like the word grievance has this connotation that it's not a legitimate grievance, which I think in this case it is a completely legitimate grievance. But it's not his job to kind of be the spokesperson for everything Hollywood has done wrong for minority and.
And I thought he was great. I think he was very consistently on that topic the entire, you know, it's a really long ceremony and he was constantly addressing it. And his last words all night were Black Lives Matter. So, you know, that's pretty
I felt his bit about the asking women more on the red carpet. I sort of wanted to go and explain the concept of patriarchy to Chris Rock, but I feel like maybe that would have been difficult for him to work into a joke set up. Well, of course, women do end up wearing more different things because women are encouraged to display themselves more.
No, and he certainly wasn't PC all night, you know. And there was that the joke that involved Asian stereotypes where they got three like young Asian children on the stage and were like, "Oh, these are accountants," and you know, a lot of people were upset by that. He by no means was like Mr. Progressive all night, but then I guess why would we expect that of him?
Yeah, I was gonna say, have these people not ever seen any previous Chris Rock material?
Why would you expect that of him?
Stephen, can you name a film that is worse than Birdman?
Ooh, yes, I can.
Go on.
People will be familiar with my number one rule, which is never to watch a film with Adam Sandler in it. Don't write in, Adam Sandler fans. I got your Eat, Pray, Love or whatever the suggestion was, and I am probably going to watch it at some point, but I haven't yet. Punch Drunk Love is apparently semi-okay.
That's the serious Adam Sandler film. I also do not watch Adam Sandler films.
But I think the worst film I've seen is... actually, I'm going for a controversial one. Forrest Gump.
No, you're not. Get out.
I think Forrest Gump is almost
the worst film ever made. Do you think it's Forrest Gump?
No, I'm just listing bad films. I don't think it's the worst film ever made. But it just goes on.
Actually, now I think
about
it, I worry that I haven't seen Forrest Gump for 10 years and that actually now it would just be like... It would actually be slightly... Like when we rewatched Friends and you were like, wow, Friends is kind of weirdly freaked out by the concept of gay people. I never really got that in the 1990s.
I think it's just mawkish and it goes on too long. And I mean, there must be a worse film than Birdman. Because, I mean, I think Birdman probably felt worse than it was because I expected to enjoy it. Whereas I imagine if I ever do end up watching The Revenant, I mean, I'm going to be disappointed. I literally did think it was 2 hours of a man fighting a bear.
No, it's more 2 hours of a man coping with the wounds after being attacked by a bear and also climbing inside a horse for no discernible reason.
I'm just going to put a shout out here for Deadpool, which I know you are all resistant to watching, but you really... That's like 2 hours of a man fighting a bear but making sassy wisecracks on the side of it.
I don't know if I like sass.
Anna, is there a film that you can name that is worse than The Revenant?
Maybe Mistress America. I'm a Mistress America hater. Sorry, everyone who likes that film.
And in your opinion, what should have won Best Picture this year?
My Best Picture of the year, which I think should have won Best Picture at the Oscars, was Magic Mike XXL.
I haven't seen that, but I've seen a lot of screen grabs on that because Zoe Margolis gave a talk in which she showed how it was a very important sign of the female gaze.
We did a panel together on it, and it's just the best film ever. Like, you have to go. Room and Carol were my favourites over Spotlight, but I was pretty happy with Spotlight.
My loathing of Room will have to be the subject of another podcast. I thought Carol or Joy... I really liked Joy. I know that there are...
What is the magic thread that links together Room, Carol and Joy?
Ladies!
Is it that they are focused on female experiences? I'm going to end on my angry conspiracy theory. Last year, Ian Leslie wrote a brilliant blog for us about the fact that, you know, Whiplash was drumming man, American Sniper was sniping man, that one with Steve Carell was basketballing man. Like, they were just very heavily centred on male experience. And that does seem to have continued this year.
Yeah. Biopics.
Watch Magic Mike XXL and Deadpool. Do not watch Forrest Gump again in case it turns out to be rubbish like Steven says.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hey, I'm John.
And I'm Barbara, and we present Skylines, the new podcast from City Metric, the New Statesman's urbanism site.
Every 2 weeks, you can hear us talk about cities, geography, and the human impact on the environment, and test our contention that maps make a great topic for radio.
You can find us on iTunes or Acast.
Check it out.
Welcome to You Ask Us, the section where you ask us. Stephen, this week I've got a really simple one that someone, well, actually many people have asked me, which is it just me or is politics really boring at the moment? I think there's a sense that basically the government has paused everything to have its 3 months long internecine row about Europe. Is that fair? Are there things coming up in Parliament that we just don't know about that just aren't getting any coverage?
Well, there are a couple of, I don't want to say small because they're all in their way quite important, but they're things which for one reason or another don't have many sort of moving parts, as it were. There's the trade union bill where the Lords keep chopping off some of the worst bits and then it shunts back to the Commons. And obviously the trade union bill has fairly apocalyptic consequences for the Labour Party and its funding and will transform, among other things, the size of the permanent Labour Party. I mean, they are probably going to end up losing about half of their staff, and no organisation loses half of its staff and is materially the same.
But it's okay then, because they will have, what, 40 fewer seats from the boundary review?
Yeah. So, it's fairly bleak.
But no one apart from the SNP will have a seat in Scotland, right? Then once if
no, partly because current boundaries. Well, the Lib Dems will keep Orkney because it's a historical. Because the boundary changes are particularly toxic for you if you're a Liberal Democrat, because your majority is entirely personal. It's about, oh, you pointed at my bins. Oh, you stopped me getting deported. I don't really know why I decided to equate those two things with as if they were of equal importance.
Two major concerns of the British electorate.
But, you know, those, if you get someone's bins fixed, they're likely to vote for you. If you stop them being deported, they're really keen to keep you in office because you've obviously transformed their life prospects. But the second your boundaries change, you've got a bunch of people whose bins you have neither fixed or whose lives you have improved for the better. Mm. And if you're a Lib Dem, that's really all you've got. So that is fairly catastrophic. But because there's not really a fight, because the Conservatives have a majority of 12 and it doesn't affect very many people other than the 8 Liberal Democrats or Labour Party staffers, at the moment neither of those issues have become acute. And then there is the WASPI campaign, which is about a legal change which means that women do much worse out of their pensions than they should. That, I think, is something which will probably ignite at some point. But I think we're still at the stage when people don't think it will affect them.
Pensions, I think, generally are going to be a flashpoint, aren't they? I mean, you've got the review coming up. There's been stuff in the papers about people working till they're 75 and actually pensions, the pensions age having to rise faster than life expectancy. And I think that adds to that narrative, which I know is quite controversial, about feeling that, you know, the current generation of pensioners, that's the high watermark of how great it's going to be a pensioner. I mean, the median pensioner is better off than the median worker. Like, there's less inequality in income in pensioners, actually. And there are, I think, more working age people in poverty now than pensioners as a proportion for the first time.
And the kind of the efforts to reduce pension poverty under the last government have proved stickier than the ones to reduce working poverty, which the Conservatives have been more successful at unpicking. You are much better off being a pensioner. Although in some ways, exactly as you say, it's kind of, historically, we may depressingly look back on that, and this is a brief phenomenon, because when Lloyd George introduced the pension, it was set well above life expectancy. The difficulty with this idea people have of, oh, you'll just work forever, is that a lot of people who get past retirement age wouldn't be able, they're living much longer, but they're living because we've got better at stopping people dying from heart attacks. You can't really go back and do your job after surviving a major heart attack in the same way. So it's
about
scary.
Good years, isn't it, rather than necessarily. And also, you know, what happens for, you know, manual workers, for example. I think this is really interesting. When I was at the Mail, we were trying to commission a piece about somebody about retiring. We were looking around for somebody to talk about, you know, why it's great to retire. And of course, none of the older columnists retire. Like, you look around the papers, you have people who are 67, 68, 70, still writing a column, because writing a column in your slippers in your North London house is something that you can absolutely still do when you're 70s. Even if you're not physically as able as you once were, being a bricklayer is not that. Being an Uber driver is not that. So we've got trade unions, we've got pension changes. Anything else?
But that that is, to be honest, about it, because mostly the government is effectively on a general election footing. It is the official position of the government, albeit not the position of many in the Conservative Party, to keep Britain in Europe, and everything they are doing is being pointed towards that aim, which is why the government is trying to do as few things as possible to irritate anyone, because they don't want to have a tax credit style disaster 2 months before getting out vote.
We've got another 3 months to go.
There are many fascinating subplots in Osborne's next budget. One is he's under so much political pressure. Two is that the economy looks like it's getting worse. Three, of course, is his targets still haven't been met. But the fourth is that, is he really going to want to implement a large sort of wave of austerity however many months before this crucial vote for both him and David Cameron's future? It's not that likely.
I just think there's absolutely no upside for him. It turns out there is no downside to him breaking his promises, as we've seen over subsequent budgets. Mm. It's not like he's going to get attacked by the SNP, by Labour, by the Lib Dems for being insufficiently,
cruel.
Yeah, cruel and tax cutting. He would absolutely get away with it. So I wouldn't be surprised if another kind of couple of billion turns up behind the sofa like last time, and magically the pace of cuts gets slowed again. Mm. I guess we'll just have to find things that aren't Europe to talk about. Again, that could be our shout out to our listeners this week. If there are other bits of politics you feel are being ignored in the great European brouhaha, then do tweet us and let us know. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, with Stephen Bush. Our producer is India Bork, and our music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can find us on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.